Radio.
Hey everyone, welcome to the latest installment of the Climbing Advocate Podcast, episode number 58, a conversation with two individuals coming out of the Southeast, Meg Evans, Executive Director of the Southeastern Climbers Coalition, and Daniel Dunn, Access Fund's Southeast Regional Manager. We covered a few main topics in this episode, but the SCC's recent acquisition of a new boulder field in northern Alabama was undoubtedly the star of the show and really laid the foundation for the rest of this conversation. This boulder field is called the Citadel. The Citadel is a 58-acre parcel located in northern Alabama, about an hour-ish south of Chattanooga, that the SCC conserved back in December of 2023. It's an incredible addition to the existing bouldering opportunities that the Southeast already has to offer at places like Stonefort, Rocktown, and Horsepens 40. The Big Three, as Daniel calls it, is now potentially the Big Four with the addition of the Citadel boulders. The process and effort it took to acquire these boulders has spanned multiple decades. And as land conservation often does, it took just the right recipe of partnership and cooperation between multiple parties for this deal to come together. Now that it has, it's just another feather in SCC's cap of successful conservation projects. They are now proud landowners of their 9th climbing area, technically kind of 11th climbing area. Over the years, they've conserved 11 climbing areas, but two of those they've transferred to the state of Tennessee. So now they're sitting on 9 SCC-owned climbing areas. In just a very short amount of time, stewardship work and assembly infrastructure commenced, getting everything in the area in tip-top shape, of course, for climbers and the general public that just want to go for a casual stroll through the woods. There seems to be maybe some friendly competition that goes on between these legendary boulder fields as to which one is truly the best, but I also know there's nothing but love for all of them from the folks that reside in or visit the Southeast. And speaking of visitors, after we concluded our discussion about the Citadel acquisition, we jumped into discussing some more facts and figures from an economic impact study that was conducted looking at the financial impact climbers have in Tennessee. I won't go into all the details here, but needless to say, the numbers are nothing short of impressive and make a very strong case for climbing being an important recreational activity in Tennessee. We then round out the conversation looking at some broader conservation efforts that are being assessed for the future also in Tennessee. We don't discuss any specific areas necessarily, but rather more about the holistic framework that's been put together to strategically identify where these opportunities lie for the future. The Access Fund calls this report the Tennessee Accelerator Report. It is really cool, and I sing its praises to Daniel towards the end of the episode. From the actual content that's captured in the report to its pleasing aesthetics, it is beautifully put together. It's really well done, and I encourage all of you to check it out. It can be found at the Tennessee Accelerator Report link in your show notes. And I think that about covers it, so let's get into it here. Please enjoy my conversation with Meg Evans and Daniel Dunn. Before we jump into the episode here, I'd like to give some thanks and show some love for the sponsors and supporters of the show. Black Diamond, Adidas Turex, and my friends at Plugged On Audio. Thank you for the continued support of the Climbing Advocate Podcast and your dedication to the climbing community. Because this is not the first time that we've had the SCC on the show. You know, you guys have gotten the spotlight multiple times. Very well deserved, of course. But, geez, I'm thinking back. Had Cody and Andrea on, I don't know, 3, maybe 4 years ago. It's been a while. When Cody was running the show, I forget what Andrea was doing at that time. If she was with the Access Fund or the SCC. I thought she was
with the Access Fund. I don't think that they overlapped. I may be wrong there. I don't think they've overlapped. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I had Caleb on in like November 22 when the annual conference was in Chattanooga. So here we are for the third time with SCC. I'm so psyched to have you on. And it's been a changing of the guard of sorts over the years. And now you're leading the show, Meg. And Daniel, you've changed positions too since we last had you on the show. So, but let's jump in with you, Meg. Want to give us a little background on yourself and when you came into the leadership role with SCC.
Yeah, sure. I have been climbing gosh, I guess for 11 or 12 years. I'll have to do some math later and fact check that, but somewhere in the ballpark of 11 and 12 years. And for as long as I've been climbing, I have been active with the SEC, whether that's just volunteering at trail days and then kind of later in my climbing and in my professional career, kind of jumped in on some acquisitions, access committee things, which ultimately I think kind of helped me transition into the role that I have now. I started with the SEC more formally in my position in September of 2021. My background is really in nonprofit and outdoor recreation, worked a lot on helping organizations do what they do best, kind of especially mission-driven organizations that have some trouble focusing on the logistics because they're so mission-driven. But fortunately with the SEC, I just had an opportunity to take a complete powerhouse of an organization and kind of keep going to that next level. So worked a lot with Andrea early on. I think that kind of led to where I am now. And it's a dream job. It's a gift that I don't think I'll ever be able to repay, being able to work for the SEC for sure.
Yeah, powerhouse indeed. That's a great adjective to use to describe the SEC. Are you based in Chattanooga or one of the surrounding states?
Oh, I'm not. Yeah, we work in Tennessee, Georgia, and Alabama, and I'm still here in Birmingham, Alabama. There's a lot of, there's just a lot of climbing, especially along the Cumberland Plateau, and a lot of that, you know, Lookout Mountain dips down all the way down and out of Alabama, runs through Georgia and up through Tennessee. And so when I took the job, I really wanted to look at the great model that had been placed for us in Chattanooga and try to replicate that in some of our other kind of major cities where we have similar partners, similar funding, similar, you know, climbing communities. So my focus was to kind of, you know, focus here in Alabama for a little while, and we'll soon kind of try to replicate those same things again in Georgia as well. I mean, we've got projects constantly going in all of those states, but trying to focus on replicating the Chattanooga model, is what we call it internally, and these other places has been a lot of fun to work on. Yeah, down here in Alabama.
Yeah, Meg, would you say that there's better rock climbing around Chattanooga or in Alabama?
Yeah,
this is a side question.
Yeah, the best stone in America is at Horsepins 40, and so you can take that to the bank for sure. No one will argue with me there. I finally did Bumboy, so I'm a local now. I would argue that Alabama still has a lot of stones left unturned that we still, you know, can get out there and get. But I don't know, you know, you mentioned Chattanooga or Alabama. I don't know if you've ever been to Rocktown, but my God, Georgia is sitting on some pretty incredible rock as well.
Best boulder field in the U.S., I think.
I don't know. It's hard to get me to go too far away from Horsepins, you know. I think that's why I stuck around down here in Birmingham. I'm about 35, 40 minutes, depending on if I'm speeding away from Horsepins. So.
Yeah, I think Chattanooga often takes the crown as like the Southeast, you know, best climbing
deserved.
In the Southeast.
Probably
overshadows, you know, Alabama and Georgia. But from what I've been learning, there's just a lot more to be had. And talking to Dave Thompson in Arkansas as well, I mean, Southeast just rocks, man. I'm like, getting ready for this episode, I swear I was on kayak.com, like looking for flights to Chattanooga because I cannot.
Come on down.
I got to sample a little bit back in 22. I went to Castle Rock and Stonefort. Oh, yeah. And so I got to do a little bit of, and the T-Wall. I went to three different places actually. So I got clips and bolts, plugged some gear, went bouldering a little bit. So I got a little sample, but
it's a well-rounded trip.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I squeeze it in for sure. But I think the meat of this conversation might be around Alabama climbing today. So I'm really psyched to give Alabama some more love, you know, some more love on the show and talk about the Citadel acquisition. So before we get into that, Daniel, why don't you jump in here and reintroduce yourself for the folks? It's your second time on the show. And like I said, I think you're with the BCC, the Boulder climbing community, last time we chatted as the stewardship guy. So why don't you jump in here and tell us about how your roles have changed over the last couple of years?
Yeah. I can't remember if I was at PCC still, if I was fresh on the job at Access Fund. But yeah, my name's Daniel Dunn. I'm the Southeast Regional Manager at the Access Fund. And so my role really entails delivering on the core program areas of Access Fund, conservation, stewardship, advocacy, all in the Southeast. And so I work in 10 states, sort of West Virginia and Kentucky on down. I'm based in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And I'm really fortunate to get to work with a lot of strong local climbing organizations like SCC and a number of other groups in this region. And I may be quite biased. I'm from the Southeast. Originally, I sort of grew up between North and South Carolina. There's a lot of great climbing, a lot of great climbing potential. But from sort of a work standpoint, there's also a lot of really interesting work to be done. You sort of have the variety of so many different federal land managers and sort of unique federal land managers, you know, unique National Park Service managed sites like national battlefields or preserves that are sort of just fun from a work standpoint, as well as all the state land, municipal land, private land. I feel like I get to utilize all the tools that I have, and I'm learning new tools to be more effective, but it's a really fun place to work for the Access Fund at, and there's a lot of opportunity and a lot of big wins that have happened in previous years and are going to continue to happen, and I hope just keep ramping up and keep happening. And yeah, I think it's been, I guess, to touch on like the evolution a little bit, I was actually just talking about this the other day where I feel like I've almost like crossed this threshold of like climbing advocacy as a career. I never thought about it like that. I've been climbing for well over a decade now. I always enjoyed rock climbing. I felt like the community in the Southeast gave me a lot and put me on a life path that I'm on now. And I had some jobs that worked in and around climbing, and I just kind of kept happening. And I sort of boomerang back and forth from the Access Fund to LCOs. And then all of a sudden now it's like I've been working in this space for 6 or 7 years, which in the grand scheme of things isn't that long, but it is, it's all of a sudden like, oh, maybe it is a career. Maybe it is a climbing advocacy career now, or it has those ambitions. But it's been a really fun experience to have that sort of multi-year relationship with Access Fund and certain LCOs and see just a variety of projects and climbing communities all around the country. That's been the most fun, is like working with all the different locals and folks who are so passionate. That's where things stand today.
Daniel, does Peter know your nickname that I've given you?
tell him the good one too. Don't tell him the bad ones.
I call him, so his name's Daniel Dunn. So we call him Dan the Man Gets It Done Dunn.
It's on my business card, actually.
He has just come in as a whirlwind and is such a resource. And I'm so grateful that he decided to use his skills down here in the South. It's been great to work with.
Yeah. Him and I have crossed paths. Several times over the years, and kind of worked in parallel a bit, and still are with my new position with the Outdoor Alliance, and just super grateful to work together with them still. And we were in DC together back in November, I can't remember now, but
In there.
It's been a number of years that we've kind of crossed paths, so it's let's keep it going. Well, let's get into like what brought us all here today on this lovely Wednesday morning. I hope it's lovely for you all in the Southeast. It's a beautiful morning in Boulder, Colorado, and it's this recent acquisition of the Citadel Boulders in northeastern Alabama. It's about less than an hour south of Chattanooga, is what Google Maps told me, Meg. So I hope that's right.
That's right.
It sounds like this has been one epic journey to get this access secured at this place. So let's start with that. And then a little bit later on, I want to take the conversation a bit more broader after that and talk about some more like broader conservation planning in the Southeast. But let's start more local, and then we'll zoom out to tie in a couple other great projects that you guys have going on. So the Citadel, let's like early 2000s, it sounds like it's been like a 20 years in the making. Bring us back, Meg, to like the early 2000s and when the SCC started seeking permanent protection of these boulders.
Oh, yeah. And I might even go a touch before that. Climbing has kind of been, happening at Citadel since late 80s, early 90s. A lot of the Southeastern legends that you hear about that put up a lot of FAs around the Southeast kind of all had some opportunities to cut their teeth there. And so, after the SEC kind of started realizing that acquisitions was a way to protect access permanently in the Southeast, and that it could be really this tool that they could use for climbers to have access. The founders, some of the early folks at the SEC, got together and did a strategic plan, and that was authored by Brad McLeod, who is absolutely legendary in the Southeast. None of us would be where we are today without him. Some other names in the room were, you know, Gus Fontenot, those folks, Lance Brock, everybody that was kind of there at the time. They put together this hit list of areas in the South that they, you know, were seeing were threatened and were facing closure. And when we say threatened, some explanation for folks that might not be in the South, that could be private land that is either, you know, susceptible to get sold for housing developments for really any number of reasons, hunting properties, you name it. Land changes hands and stuff like that all the time. So the SEC put together this list, and right there on that list near the very top was the Citadel. And from that point up until we closed on it December 1st in 2023, the SEC has actively been trying to get that property, secure that property. And so lots of different hands, lots of different community members, advocates have worked on that project to try to make it happen. And we were fortunate that kind of the right players and the right, you know, partners and the right, you know, landowners for that matter, kind of all came together and were able to finally make it happen. I think it's really cool. Earlier, I talked about kind of applying that Chattanooga model to other, you know, areas. When we were opening up the Citadel, I talked a lot about how this has been a long-term project of the SEC, and kind of likened it to projecting, you know, your own climb or something. It's you learn a little bit about how to do things, you apply all of that knowledge to try to get a little further on your project, and finally one day it all comes together and it just kind of, you know, feels smooth and it feels like you're climbing hard and, you know, you're sending. And that's truly what the Citadel felt like to me. I felt like it was this culmination of efforts, of knowledge, of community members that all brought something to the table. And we were finally able to kind of push it over the finish line and get it closed on. And then, you know, less than 4 months later, we opened it, which is kind of nuts. But again, because of the partners in our community, I mean, we had tons of volunteers getting in there, cleaning up graffiti. We had the parking lot, you know, get done thanks to Vulcan Materials, like just really, really all kinds of partners came together. Some of the big ones that come to mind are the Riverview Foundation, the Lyndhurst Foundation, and of course the Access Fund. I mean, Daniel Dunn was right there with me every step of the way. The first person I called after I got the email confirming we had engaged the landowners was Daniel Dunn to say, okay, what do we do? You know, how are we going to do this?
Dunn's getting it done, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. I think the Meg's point, it did really feel like this culmination of, yeah, so many different experiences from, I mean, the partnership, strong partnership between Access Fund and SEC, as well as, yeah, I think SEC's evolution in a way over time of acquiring pieces of land, conserving them, and then becoming land managers and figuring that piece out. Like, this really felt, the opening ceremony felt, I mean, very professional. And I mean, it's just, you know, amazing parking lot. The signage was there. We had the mayor out. There was ribbon cutting. There was a tour. It just, it kind of felt like, you kind of look around, you're like, man, who's putting this on? Climbers are putting this on. This is really, this is really professional. We're forced to be reckoned with. And I think, yeah, I think that comes from that. It's, yeah, it's been a winding long path and there's been a lot of wins along the way, but it felt like a moment where it was like everything really came together, which is really cool to see.
Yeah, it's something you should be incredibly proud of. And you were just talking a little earlier about having a career in climbing advocacy. And, you know, I was kind of in my head broadening that a little bit. I mean, you're part of a I'm not sure if I even like the word movement, but you're part of this like larger national conservation movement. I mean, you're contributing to something so much bigger than like its parts. And I think that's what you should be incredibly proud of, what we should be incredibly proud of. And it's still, like I say this in so many episodes, it just, it blows my mind that, yeah, climbers are landowners, they're land managers, and we're making a big difference in what recreation looks like in different regions around the country, and what land ownership looks like, what stewardship looks like, what, you know, it's so many things I can keep going on, but I'll leave it at that. And to say congratulations first and foremost on this new acquisition. Great work.
Yeah, thanks. I would just extend that congratulations to every member that we have, every, you know, volunteer, everybody that's put in the time and effort. You talked about, you know, it's incredible to see climbers do these things, and it's really only possible because we are a true coalition, you know, folks that kind of bring so many different things to the table to make that possible. It is amazing to me that the SEC to date has now purchased 11 climbing areas in a parking lot, two of which have been transferred over to the state of Tennessee and our state parks, and we still own and manage 9 climbing areas. Like, that's just not, it's not something you hear about every day, you know, right, that climbers are doing this, but it's possible because of our coalition of folks that kind of come together. And it's, mm-hmm, it's honestly amazing. It was a really special thing to be able to stand there with a lot of the members of that coalition on that day and open up this property.
Yeah. And it's not like climbing just started happening there on December 1st when you closed, right? So like, it's been going on there for a while. So what did it look like early on? Was it like a handshake agreement? Was it kind of under the radar?
It was trespassing.
It was just straight up trespassing.
Yeah, it's trespassing. So that was kind of what early on got me involved in it was, you know, before I knew better, I, you know, would go to the Citadel, and it was kind of a, okay, if there's more than a couple cars, you move on to a different area. And once I kind of learned more about climbing access and what that could do to, you know, future access, I said, man, we got to stop doing this. You know, we've got to figure out a better solution. So I vowed to never go again until the SEC owned it.
Nice.
And it worked out. yeah, and I actually called Andrew Hassler early on and said, hey, this place is going to get, I mean, there's only really kind of one outcome to this if climbers don't get involved. And that's, you know, it gets blown up, the spot gets blown up, and, you know, inevitably it closes, whether that's because of contentions with, you know, neighbors, or because it gets bought and sold and blown up and turned into houses, which very much can and does and has happened in the Southeast time and time again. And so, yeah, I think it's what it looked like was, yeah, under the radar, trying our best to kind of keep it, you know, tell folks to stay out, you're compromising access, you know, trying to get it taken down off of different sites and things, and trying to get folks to remove things off of social media and all of that. It was just kind of this ticking time bomb, you know, of it's going to go one way or the other. And fortunately, you know, it went in our favor.
Yeah. Maybe to chime in too, sorry, with a little additional context there, like, think for like the, maybe zooming out for the larger Southeast region, I think that feeling or that thought about access is not secure and we might lose it, it's been confirmed, you know, numerous times, from North Carolina, South Carolina, Tennessee, Alabama, Georgia. Those, almost every one of these states in the Southeast has an example of maybe not well known, but a cherished climbing resource that was never had any sort of land protection on it. It was private land. The climbers had gone out and explored, and whether climbers tried or maybe they never tried and simply lost it. So there's been just so many examples of that. I think that's a big part of the culture for climbing in the Southeast is, or maybe it's a question mark in some ways, like, you know, how folks approach it. But I think most people generally understand that protected access, that legal protected access to climbing is huge, and that people have been burned, and that colors their interest in sort of advocacy and involvement with an LCO. And so it's just, I think it's a feeling and a sentiment that a lot of climbers in the Southeast have and have been directly burned by potentially, from another example. And so, yeah, it's especially cool to see one like this where for so long, there were so many potential chances where it could have been sold or gone to an unfriendly landowner or just been simply closed or posted with no trespassing. You know, was able to find a path and sort of thread the needle to get it where it is permanently protected now and owned by the SEC.
Is that the narrative, like, that you guys use to market, like, securing access? Like, I'm trying to find the best way to ask this, but is it like, oh my God, we could lose access to this permanently? Is that the best way to, like, communicate to folks to get them engaged, or how do you guys navigate that?
I don't think so. And oh my gosh, Peter, what a $1 million question. Gosh, what a $1 million question. Hey, if you figure out the best way to market to folks for access, you let me know.
Sure, absolutely.
But no, I think it's a lot of different messages and the way that I kind of phrase it internally to our, you know, education committee, to our access committee, to our board, to my two staff, is that we kind of have to go all gas, no brakes, because the other side is also going all gas, no brakes. And what I mean by the other side is, you know, like those developers, not developers in terms of a climbing sense, but housing, you know, for example, there's an area that's 10, 15 minutes from my house that's now a shopping center, and it used to be a boulder field. And so it's tough to drive by that, you know, quite frequently and just think about it, right? But no, I personally don't always love the tactic of, oh, we could lose it at any moment, because I don't know that that resonates with everybody, because a lot of newer climbers, maybe they don't know about, you know, they haven't seen that firsthand. I do think it's important to look back at our history and educate on that and talk about those closures and talk about the risk and talk about those things that have happened. But I think thinking about our collective potential and possibility as a huge group and what we're capable of doing, and if everybody gets on board and is kind of pulling their weight, you know, towards this ultimate goal of, you know, I want everything. I want every area in the Southeast in my region to be protected, open access. You know, I want that. And I think that is a much more compelling motivator than, you know, just the fear of, oh, you know, we could lose it. I think it's healthy and we need to make space for that and hold it, because that is a really real thing that can happen. And it does happen. And I do think it's important for us to point to those examples and talk about that. But for me, what I find kind of more motivating and more inspiring is to think about, if each of us is pulling our weight and coming to the table with whatever it is, whatever skill set that we have, that we can kind of be off to the races making these things happen together. It's a lot more inspiring. It's a lot more motivating to me to think about the potential of, what if it goes our way? What if we, you know, all are doing this together and we're all making sure we're following the access, you know, regulations and guidelines, and we're showing up at stewardship days. Maybe we're taking photos so that we can share those for a grant proposal, whatever it is, you know, we're all working together to make this kind of larger thing happen. Yeah. And we do that in a number of ways. We've got an education committee that puts out all kinds of know before you go ethics information, you know, stuff like that about how to recreate at a crag responsibly and how to leave no trace and all of that. We've just, yeah, all gas, no brakes is the is the method over here.
I think too, like to add on there, like I think it's also just a sensitive thing. You talk about messaging, like land acquisitions, private land protection is a sensitive topic, and you know, really the best practice is to not talk about some of these things until the deals are made and, you know, the agreements are signed and whether you've closed on a property or you've recorded an easement or however your strategy is. And so it can be a tricky thing to talk about, because, you know, I'm sure, you know, pretty much everyone who's external to the SEC and Access Fund who are involved in this deal, maybe outside of, you know, SEC board members, like there's so much work went into this project over the years, and you know, no one's going to find out about that. And that's fine. You don't need to necessarily know all the details, but it's hard to illustrate how much work some of these projects take to get them to this final solution where we can all celebrate. And I think that's where, yeah, that education piece comes in so important, and letting folks understand that, you know, acquisition and land protection is an aspect of the climbing advocacy work for Access Fund, for LCOs. And there's other parts too that are a little bit more easy to plug into, like stewardship things, for example, where it's like everyone can, it's easier to get folks engaged for that. And then there's this understanding that, hey, we're also, as an organization, working toward these land protection things. We can't necessarily talk about them, but we're working on them. And, you know, trust us that these things are happening. And this is the behind the scenes work that fills the 40 plus work hour a week, right. You know, to get these things to a point where we can have a win and celebrate them and talk about them. And so, yeah, I think to Meg's point earlier, it's a challenging thing to message around, and I think we've done a good job in a lot of ways, and I think there's other ways too. We're just getting the understanding out to folks. These projects are complex, and take hours and hours of behind the scenes staff work and due diligence, and sometimes span 20 plus years. It's a hard thing to convey to the general climbing community.
Right. Yeah, to kind of piggyback off that a little bit, you're absolutely right. It's tough because, gosh, there were so many times that I got asked during the time that we were working on the acquisition. I mean, we were actively working, we were engaged with the lender, and we were having conversations. We were fundraising at that point. We were securing, you know, grants to make sure that we were going to be off to the races when it came down to the day to close. There were so many times when folks would message me, "Hey, is SEC ever going to do anything about the Citadel?" And I said, I promise you, I'm working on it, you know, and that's all we can really say. And so, you know, when we're asking folks to, hey, take that down, you know, please don't go climb there until we've got proper access or whatever the case may be, right? It's because, man, I promise you, when we say we're working on it, you know, and so it's been exciting for us to now, looking back, being able to tell that story of the Citadel and everything that went into it, because oftentimes, like Daniel said, we can't talk about it while it's happening because it's a sensitive land acquisition. That is an active deal that's on the table, right? And we just can't talk about that.
Yeah, no, thanks for trying to answer that $1 million question, because it probably take, yeah, I mean, geez, like, I mean, you mentioned the kind of fear-based rhetoric and like the doom and gloom like approach to it, and that's not always the best way. And maybe it'll resonate with maybe some of the old guard that have seen places, you know, come and go over the years, and maybe with some of the newer climbers, the better approach is, hey, you have an opportunity to be involved here and look like what we can do, and just something a little bit more of a positive spin, or put it under a positive light than the doom and gloom approach. So yeah, trying to target different audiences with different messages. I mean, this will take some kind of like probably psychology marketing expert, you know, to dissect and figure out, but I think you guys are obviously doing a great job at that. So was it just like an individual, was it an individual landowner that had that owned the land before you guys?
You know, so the lore of the area, as long as I could remember, was that it was this, you know, family that, you know, all had their hands in it and they couldn't decide what to do. But really what ended up happening was, and I think I can kind of speak to this a bit, is that, it's this family, the Klatt family. Ernest Klatt was the patriarch of that family, and he kind of worked around the United States in exchange for land. And so he had built this kind of better life, this better setup for his family, and what he gave them was land. And so this land was really, really special to this family. So special, in fact, that Ernest, I mean, he loved rocks, he loved gems, he loved all these kind of cool formations. And so it was fortunate that Citadel was held a special place to this family, you know, it's held a special place in their heart and in their, and in their kind of, you know, in their family as a whole. And so, in talking with them, in that it, you know, they knew that climbers were the right fit to appreciate and respect and, you know, take care of that land. And so ultimately I think, our persistent efforts, because when we originally talked to them, they said, hey, we even got your letters back in, you know, whatever the year was that we sent those out, early 2000s. And so they knew that we had had an interest for a long time. And so when it came time for them to finally do something about it, they called us first. And I know, we were not the only folks that were interested in that. It's a very cool resource for Fort Payne. And so, I just feel very lucky and fortunate that, yeah, they decided that because of these special rock formations that were important to Ernest and Elsie, his daughter, it was just very cool that they ended up, getting a deal, with us. Mm-hmm.
So how big are we talking here? How many acres? How many
boulder? So it's, just shy of 60 acres. So it's a pretty big little plot there. And the boulder field is kind of just a portion of that, right? But it's probably got, Daniel, maybe 40, 45, individual sandstone boulders, but a lot of those are corridors, mazes, things like that. It's got, you know, more than 150 individual boulder problems. And then some, that's just what we've kind of uncovered so far, looking back and talking to folks like Adam Henry, trying to talk to Watford, you know, those folks, trying to figure out, and Cormany, of course, figuring out those cool Cormany slabs, what they've put up. My husband is actually helping to put together the little PDF that you can get on our website right now. I mean, it is truly an incredible maze. Bruz Clark, who's one of the foundations, he's executive director of two of the foundations that gave to us, described it as a constellation of rock formations. And I just think that is the best you know, way to describe it, because it is. It's just got so many unique, individual, cool things. I mean, it's got roofs. It's got, you know, cool pockets in Waco's. It's got the, you know, classic sloper squeezes. It's got cool pressing, you know, water grooves where you're slabbing it out. I mean, it has just got everything, man. It is truly spectacular. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, I mean, some very unique sandstone features too, you know, like some of the classic boulders there, like the hanging of red or the snail, just out of this world, sort of strange features you don't really get anywhere else. And right. Yeah, it's obviously the climbing side of it is an amazing boulder field, and it's just a beautiful location. And it's even fun just to walk around through. There's a little bit of a path you can sort of weave between some of these corridors, and it's just a fun place to walk around. And I need to put it in scale too. Like I'm sure we can expand more about this with the climbing specific side of it, but you know, there's people think about, when they think about the Southeast, they talk about sort of the big three, or maybe the Tennessee, Alabama, Georgia region, talk about the big three boulder fields, which are Stonefort, Horsepins 40, and Rocktown. And, you know, and certainly in my opinion, I think Citadel pushes right up into there. And is one of those sort of top tier, you know, I think will be international bouldering locations in the Southeast, now that it's officially protected. You could argue that it was an international destination before, since folks would go there before it was totally protected from, you know, they were visiting from outside the country for, you know, the Chattanooga region or Stonefort or Horsepins 40, would end up going to Citadel. But truly a special resource and a special boulder field that's right up there with the best things we have in the Southeast.
All right. Well, the big four now, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of crazy. It's our fifth property in Alabama now, which is nuts.
Oh, cool.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Alabama's on the map.
That's right. I mean, it truly is. Some of our other recent wins that we've had there in Alabama. And again, just kind of trying to replicate what we've done there in Tennessee, and trying to kind of use that as a template. We're really kind of on a roll. We've got a lot of steam down here in Alabama currently. There's a lot of projects on the map. There's a lot of projects that we've had some cool wins on, you know, so no shortage of great stone down here. Definitely worth the trip for sure.
Well, see, you already got some work done since the closing of a parking lot put in. Oh, yeah. and some signage, it sounds like. What's still pending? Anything else stewardship related or infrastructure related that you're working on for the Citadel?
Yeah. So, I mean, really, really great question. So classic boulder field management, right? So there's a lot of kind of little trails, lots of different ways to get to the same place. And so our main priority in getting the property open was to, one, kind of identify a loop trail that would take you throughout the property, so that Fort Payne residents, folks that just wanted to come out, walk their dog on a leash, please, of course, through the property could enjoy that little out and back little loop trail. So that's been kind of defined and cleaned up. But some of the other things that we look forward to doing are just some revegetation of some areas, and kind of just identifying stronger pathways that are a little bit more efficient to get from one place to another. We still have some signage that needs to go in, wayfinding signage, but kind of waiting to do that until we can really identify the best place for that. And then we've got some little drainage things here and there that we want to take care of. We are going to be working with a local university to do an ecological study as well. So that'll be cool to kind of identify any kind of plants and things that we want to make sure and take special care around. Just, you know, little things like that as we put the land management plan together. And I'm trying to think of anything else that Kate would be screaming at the top of her lungs right now, our strategic director, making sure that I'm covering. but yeah, I mean, really, we already knocked out more than 2,200 square feet of graffiti. We hauled out tons of trash. We cleaned up, you know, 1,200 feet of trail. Like, just a lot of work really went in already to get so much done. We had 50 volunteers come out. 2,600 feet of trail. Is the figure I've got here. We got a kiosk that's made with a great map that was put together by Cal Graffio for any of your GIS needs. really, really just boulder field management is really the next step of stewardship land management there. Yeah.
Awesome. Bathrooms?
That's a great question. You got bathroom money for me, Peter?
No, I certainly don't. I figured that's what you were going to say. Like tens no, of that's great. Of dollars.
Yes. It is so funny. You know, as long as I've been in my nonprofit career, I tell you what, bathrooms are some of the trickiest things to get funded. 100%. I don't know why nobody wants to put their name on a pit toilet, you know? Yeah. Listen, we'll put it in lights, honey. We'll make it happen. But I would love to have some bathroom facilities. Fortunately, maybe the MAPCO down the street won't love that I say this, but there's plenty of facilities that you can kind of stop in, grab you a little coffee or something on the way in. There's definitely places to use restroom locally. We definitely want to get some wag bag stations and things in there for the time being, but I would love to, and this goes for a couple of our other properties as well, hospital. So the areas we would love to make that happen, but it's quite expensive. So I think that's definitely a long-term plan for Citadel for sure.
Well, last thing I wanted to maybe touch on, we don't have to get too deep into it, but as a landowner, I always like speak about recreational use statutes from just like a personal recreator standpoint. Like, oh yeah, the landowner is protected under a state recreational use statute. And and now when I say landowner now, it's like, it's you guys, it's the SCC. So
that's right.
You know, I want to know like kind of what's involved with working with these, you know, insurance protection, so to speak, as a landowner. Like, how do you navigate that, and how might the one in Alabama differ from Tennessee or Georgia, or is it all kind of ubiquitous?
No, that's a great question. In Tennessee, Georgia, and Alabama, yes, you're right. There are rec statutes. I'm obviously not an attorney, but I deal with our land, our line management, talking about risk with different land managers all the time. And it's funny, in all of our work that we do, we work with private land managers, we work with public land managers, and of course, the third option is we own the land ourselves. One of the biggest things that you're going to get asked about and that you talk about often is risk management, right? Thankfully, the Access Fund has put together a lot of really great resources that we can often share for folks that are interested in kind of learning more about that risk management from a land management perspective. But in Alabama, climbing is actually listed in the recreational use statutes. It's called out, as a specific, hey, you know, this is a normal use of the land, which I think is great, because oftentimes it's a little bit of an educational piece trying to get land managers to understand climbing is a normal recreational use of your property. It's no longer the cliffhangers. It's no longer, you know, these movies that you've got in your head, you know. We of course work with Alliant and kind of have our just normal policies for each of our, you know, properties and all. But we don't charge. It's free and open to the public. We of course kind of have the rec use listed on our property maps. You know, climbing is inherently dangerous, all of that stuff. So there's a lot of ways through signage and just education that you can kind of, you know, make sure that you've got protections in place. But we are no strangers to the risk management talk and to that piece, because it's definitely high on folks' minds, right? Because when they think of climbing, they might have these other examples in their head, and they don't think of it as just me, you, and Daniel going out for a day, you know, sitting on pads, eating some snacks, spotting each other on the snail. You know, they don't think of it like that. So,
yeah, I think to add a little more on this, I think it's, I mean, Meg covered really well. It's the same, you know, the same pitch and strategies we share with any other landowner are the same strategies that, you know, climbers and LCOs use. Yes, it's kind of nice in a way where, you know, we're not making things up. You know, these strategies are the same strategies we would implement if we were the landowners. And I think that's, I think it's a helpful case almost, where certainly, I mean, no one wants to be the first at anything. You know, any land manager, you know, whether municipal or state land manager, they want to be the first one to manage a new use. But being able to show examples from other states, and also just, hey, you know, the SEC as a land manager also manages a climbing area, and here's the strategies they use. Here's our risk management strategy. And it lines up very much with the same resources that Access Fund has had for many years now and shared widely. So I think it's like a proof is in the pudding sort of deal, which sort of helps bolster this idea that, yeah, climbing is just a normal recreational activity. There's ways to manage this perceived high risk. And effectively manage an area. And here's 9 examples of it from SEC.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's one thing too. It's like a lot of times, a phrase that I learned back from Zach Lashui, and Daniel, I've heard you say this a couple times too, like climbers, sometimes LCOs and things will think about, okay, well here's all the structure and infrastructure where we can manage ourselves. And they tend to overcomplicate things, you know, where really, really the narrative and like I said, the example that we try to lead by is that this is a normal recreational use and here's how you do it, you know? And it can be quite simple. Yeah.
And it's when you start charging folks for entry, is that when the statute kind of gets negated?
Daniel, I'd love to hear kind of some of your thoughts on that. Again, I'm really not an attorney, but yeah. I think it kind of gets where your duty of care or something is a bit increased, but there's still plenty of ways to kind of manage that risk and manage that where, you know, we work with lots of different land managers where, yeah, they definitely are charging a little entry fee to cover, you know, cleaning up the bathrooms and the campsites and things like that. And they found ways to kind of manage that risk and still find a successful way of doing that where they feel comfy and, you know, they're running a great operation there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And to chime in too, I'm also not an attorney, but I think generally that's how, you know, the understanding of the recreational use statutes is most of them will specifically list, you know, a no charge or no charge for access as part of that requirement. And so, yeah, that concept of duty of care, I think really is what most attorneys will dive into, is if you're charging for some level of access, then the duty of care you have as the landowner who's charging for that increases. And so you might have to look at other strategies to mitigate that. And that might be something like an additional or more costly insurance, a liability insurance policy. It might be something like an additional signage or a waiver system. There's a couple ways to get at it. But I think, you know, generally any sort of money changing hands increases this, you know, liability exposure. And so then therefore would hopefully you'd compensate for that in your risk management plan.
And I think the approach we typically try to take is, you know, anytime I go to talk to land managers, like I said, we work with private, public, and what I mean by private could be, you know, Mr. Joe Bob, who's got boulders in his backyard and we're striking an agreement with him, or it could be a private land manager like land trust, right? Or it could be public. What I'm referring to there is from municipal up to federal. Just depending on what it is that their goals are for the management of their property, we can pretty seamlessly find ways for climbing to be, you know, complementary, symbiotic, whatever the word you want to use there, based on what they need. So, yeah. There's a number of strategies that Daniel has mentioned that we can work with, whether they're charging, not charging, or whatever the case may be. We've seen lots of different successful examples, and it just varies, you know, from land manager. And that's a lot of the kind of behind the scenes work that I think a lot of climbers don't realize goes into, you know, them showing up at the crag that day. You know, there's lots of conversations, lots of advocacy, lots of stuff that goes into even, you know, making that possible. Oftentimes I say that, you know, land managers, they don't just wake up in the morning and say, you know what sounds cool? Rock climbing. Let's just go ahead and make that happen on my property. Like, this is not a thing that happens. With the exception of maybe Alabama State Parks, that is definitely how that has kind of been going down recently. But, you know, typically it's a conversation. It's trying to find what they're comfortable with and trying to find strategies and management practices that are going to be fit within what they're wanting to do at that park or at that property. So shortage of examples we can point to.
Yeah. I think just to drive on a little more on that same topic. And I think a way that's maybe easier for, you know, anyone in the climbing community to understand sort of this behind the scenes work, especially when it relates to land protection or secured access, if you will, is sort of this idea of rungs on a ladder. And, you know, we have numerous tools and strategies we can implement. You know, Access Fund is a Land Trust Alliance certified land trust. And so we have a lot of expertise and tools and strategies we can implement. And each scenario is a little bit different. And you can sort of think about the rungs as, you know, scaling up in terms of your protection level. You think of a handshake agreement being a lower rung and outright fee simple acquisition, you know, climber owned land as being the top rung. And each of those rungs comes with additional security, but it also comes with additional cost and management consideration and legal concerns to weigh. And so I think that's the game that gets played with a lot of these areas, is understanding the setup and what, you know, the local community wants to see, understanding the concerns of the landowner or the land manager, and then trying to slot them in at the appropriate rung, whether it's a handshake agreement might be enough for this location and we feel is a secure enough method for public access, or we need to scale up to a recreational lease or agreement, or we scale up even farther to an easement. And sometimes we scale all the way up to a full-on acquisition like Citadel. And so I think that's maybe a way to understand some of the work that goes into this. And then every one of those rungs has its own can of worms of due diligence and considerations. But at least to me, that feels like a lot of what I spend my time doing, understanding the setup, finding the right rung, the right tool, if you will, and implementing it on the ground.
Great, great explanation. Man, I have 100 more questions now because this is kind of this is bringing me back to my private land conservation work when I used to work for a land trust. And could you argue like one more rung above just you guys or the SCC owning it? I mean, where I'm going with that is like an additional piece of protection. Is there a conservation easement now on top of you guys being the landowner?
Yeah, that is definitely a goal of mine for each of our properties. Obviously, the cost and the process is pretty significant for us to go through that. But that is absolutely I think I don't want to speak incorrectly here, but I'm pretty sure Mike Reardon with the CCC is kind of exploring the recreational easements on their properties and is kind of working through that process. And I had a conversation with him early on in my time with SEC, kind of exploring that, but that is absolutely something that we want to see happen because, of course, yeah, we own it and we don't plan, we don't have plans to change that anytime soon. But we, of course, would want to make sure that, anytime that if our properties, for example, go to the state of Tennessee or something like that, we have agreements in Tennessee. We have a climbing management plan that's statewide for the park system. So we've got some great protections there. But yeah, we want to ensure that that we do have that permanent, in perpetuity language, which can really, really come and be strong with an easement. Definitely a goal, definitely something that long term I'd love to explore and kind of solidify within our organization, because I think that is the ultimate end all be all, permanent protection that I would love to see on our properties for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, no, Jim,
thanks for asking it. Great question.
Yeah, yeah. Access One holds a couple different conservation easements on a variety of lands and a couple examples of climber owned or LCO owned properties. Bolton Dome in the Northeast, and properties that the Red River Gorge Climbers Coalition owns in the Red, Pendergrass Murray Recreational Reserve, Bald Rock, Miller Fork, all are owned by local climbing coalitions and also have conservation easements that are held by the Access Fund overlaid on them. And so, yeah, it's something we've done before and we certainly like to explore. And yeah, it is that sort of ultimate in perpetuity protection. And also, I think creates an environment where the sort of standard of land protection and stewardship even goes up, where those types of agreements come with certain things in terms of annual monitoring and sort of the level at which you're maintaining them that I think are good things to explore and sort of elevate that language around really the climbing and the conservation intersection, where we're not just holding this area just for rock climbing. We're also holding it and managing it for any number of conservation-related purposes, whether it be sort of the timber side of it or the forest health, watershed health, species protection. Those things can all get categorized really well under those conservation easements and then permanently protected. And so, yeah, it's a strategy we certainly like to see and implement and standing by, waiting for any LCO who wants to overlay a CE.
Yeah. Thanks. No, thanks for that explanation. You're held to a bit of a higher standard in a way with some of those guidelines that are outlined in a CE for sure. And sometimes certain funders will require a CE be put on the property if you're going to use their money to protect an area. So, yep, was just curious about that. We kind of got in the weeds of more, conservation lawyers speak with the recuse statute and stuff, but that's really good background for folks to kind of get hip to. Well, if that's it for the Citadel, again, congratulations. I really, tip my hat to the SEC's perseverance and hard work to get this place secure and open up another awesome bouldering opportunity in the Southeast. Just great job. Great, great job.
Yeah, thanks. I'll extend that to the entire group again, because like I said, we are a coalition in every sense of the word. And so it just would not have gotten done without this coalition of climbers for sure.
Absolutely. let's zoom out a bit and talk bigger picture economics and conservation, future conservation planning related to climbing in the Southeast. I'm not sure who got this economic impact study started, but you all had an economic impact study conducted and co-authored by the legendary James Maples, the one and only, and a few of his colleagues, looking at a number of economic factors that contribute to climbing in Tennessee. And I'll just list off a few key figures here. 113,000 annual climber visits to four main, the study was conducted over four main areas in Tennessee, not the whole state, but 113,000 annual climber visits, a little over $14 million in spending, and supporting a little over $4 million in wages and over 100 direct jobs in Tennessee. I mean, those are pretty meaningful figures and can be very persuasive when it comes to fundraising and future grant writing, right? So what are your guys' takeaways from this study and how does it lend itself to future conservation planning in Tennessee?
Yeah, it was a really impressive study. And yeah, huge shout out to Dr. James Maples for his work here and his work on so many of these reports. He's made so many of them for us over the years. This past year, or slowly starting in 2022, we had tried to take a more focused approach on some of our land protection work and just expanded access. In Tennessee, it's really for the Southeast region in general. We just started in Tennessee, having a familiarity there, and commissioned this report with Dr. James Maples and a great cohort of other researchers. The focus was sort of a statewide report, but climbing in Tennessee only really happens in the eastern part of the state. And so, yeah, focus is really on these sort of four kind of core climbing areas in the state, with really the biggest one being sort of the greater Chattanooga area, where the majority of open, accessible rock climbing areas are at, and where there's been a lot of investment and interest on a national scale in climbing there. And the numbers were astounding. I think I'd have to go back and look, but I think it's one of the highest in terms of stats we've seen in terms of money brought into a region that we've done. And we've done studies in Bishop and Lander and in the Red. I think the Red actually might be a little bit more. That might be the highest one. But either way, it's stacked up really highly and really put, I think, for myself and a few other folks, Chattanooga on the radar is like a real economic driver argument that has been made in Chattanooga around outdoor recreation for a long time now. It's backed up. and there's been other studies before. There was a study in 2016 around Hamilton County, but there's been a lot of growth since then. And so, yeah, that report has been great to, I think, frame that for us. And now really the plan is how do we shop it around? How do we get it in the hands of the right folks? So much of the work in Tennessee and in the Southeast around rock climbing and rock climbing development, it's really closely tied to rural economic development. A lot of these climbing areas take place in more rural counties or more rural municipalities. And some of these areas, have economies that have been staggering or have been either declining or stagnant for a number of years, or even some of them are in a full-on transition mode, going from, say, a more extractive-based industry, whether it be timber, oil and gas, coal, and they're looking for some new driver. And I think this is partially from access, but also just partially from some of the specific states understanding that tourism and outdoor recreation can play a big role in that. I think we're seeing that more on a national scale. And then reports like this really help us drive it home in the Southeast that I think it can be especially potent in some of these rural communities. Take for the counties around Chattanooga, Squatchie County, Ray County, Marion County. It can be a real force. I think that for us right now, the challenge is we know it's impressive now and anecdotally we've known it from the climbing community, but how do we get that in front of those county commissioners and the city officials or the city mayors and turn it into a win on the ground, whether that's a partnership with one of these areas for a climbing area or a stewardship agreement or just finding a better pathway to work forward. That's sort of where we're at right now, but yeah, impressive numbers. And I hope we can continue to expand these. I mean, we've done, this was our second report in Tennessee and in the Chattanooga area, but we've never done one in Alabama. I don't think we've done one in Georgia. I don't know the one has been done. I think there's a lot of potential to expand that and have these documents for every region.
For sure.
Yeah. I'll, jump on that a bit. I think one of the coolest things, like Daniel just talked about, is how we're able to take those numbers with the 2016 study that was done. You know, we get invited to present to land managers in Tennessee, in Georgia, in Alabama. We get opportunities to, you know, meet with representatives in particular areas, whether that's mayors or, you know, representatives that are there for county. And we have an opportunity to turn to those studies. And this is a little bit of that behind the scenes work that we don't often, like, how do you communicate to your, you know, public that, hey, we went and presented some economic studies today. Mm-hmm. It's not the exciting, you know, cool climbing footage that maybe you expect from an LCO, but that is absolutely the work that we're doing, is advocating for us as a user group, and that, hey, we have a seat at the table. We need to be, you know, we are a force to be reckoned with. We need to be considered when it comes to what the state might be planning to do with their recreational funding, you know, whether that's acquisitions or improvements to climbing amenities, things like that. So kind of the way that we can use things like this is to maybe tip the scales in our favor. Those are some of the wins that Daniel's kind of talking about there, whether that's, you know, acquisitions or improvements or partnerships. We are able to kind of show that, hey, when you turn the faucet on for climbing in your community, it has real deal positive impacts, especially in these kind of rural distressed communities where a lot of these climbing locations end up being, right? They're mm-hmm. in these incredible rural spaces a lot of times that, you know, are looking for a way to kind of bolster some economic development there on the ground. So it has real deal great impacts that we're able to kind of show to these communities.
I mean, when you speak dollars and cents like this, especially high dollars and cents like this, I mean, you're definitely getting some ears that are going to perk up. And part of me, gosh, a little part of me is like, why does everything have to hinge on dollars and cents and job creation? Just like, I wish we could, I'm going to get like a little meta here, but I wish we could, like, you know, convince people that conserving land and protecting land for the sake of conserving land is, there's some inherent value in that, but placing, you know, a concrete number in valuation on that is really tough. And so when speaking to these officials and stuff, and if you, you know, communicate your messaging and your mission and objectives here through job creation and wages and spending, I mean, you're hard pressed not to get their attention.
Yeah, that's a good point, Peter. I think, I mean, part of that conversation is, and this report helps with that, is, you know, folks understand, yeah, the dollars and cents side of it, but, you know, through reports like this and highlighting that climbing and outdoor recreation is a driver, it has to happen under certain circumstances, and one of those sort of circumstances is protected access. You know, something we really try and push is that you can't have this amenity or recreational resource that draws in the type of attention that brings this kind of funding or brings this kind of money to the region if it's not secure, because then it can't be talked about, it can't be promoted. And so I think mm-hmm. that, I think people are starting to see that connection more and more, that yes, outdoor recreation is the driver, and it can be an economic driver. And one of the sort of requirements of that is sort of land protection, and that plays into this larger conservation element. I think we're seeing more and more folks understand that you know, this land can have this sort of dual purpose. If we can have this protected land that is an amenity to our community, it can have certain things like outdoor recreation or any variety of draws, and that brings folks in. And so it's sort of that, I think that, and this is, I think, an interesting role that outdoor recreation can play, is it can be sort of the door opener for these other conversations, larger conversations around conservation and protected landscapes. And can be kind of the glue in some ways that binds people. You know, it's the connection to the land that I think ultimately speaks in folks involved with conservation and certainly with recreation. I think that it can play that for folks. It really ties you. You have an experience on a piece of land that's a special bond that makes you want to protect it. And it's the gateway, if you will, the Trojan horse, maybe, to conservation. That's what I think climbing can play.
Yeah, I agree. And this will play into kind of our final topic here, but, you know, thinking more holistically outside of just the recreational value is, you know, protecting these areas for climbing or another recreational asset. I mean, you're probably also protecting some wildlife habitat, a watershed, air quality, water quality, and, you know, and so on. So let's segue into kind of our final topic here and talk about this accelerating climbing access in Tennessee report that the Access Fund put together. And we could wrap it up with that. And I want to give it a little sneak peek. I know it's not like publicly available quite yet, but I mean, this report was so impressive. I mean, not to mention like aesthetically beautiful and pleasing just to look at and scroll through, that very thoroughly summarizes present climbing opportunities in Tennessee, but also takes a really close look into future conservation planning in Tennessee. And I know that you guys talk about resilient landscapes in this report that just kind of goes beyond just the value of climbing in these areas. So Daniel, can you give us maybe a little snapshot or sneak peek into what I'm speaking of here?
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, before I jump into it, I want to highlight this report was really a community effort. There were a lot of folks that played a role in this. Meg and Southeastern Climbers Coalition doing a lot of the on-the-ground data work and getting the case studies and really highlighting so much of the work that they have done in this report. And then our friends over at the University of Tennessee, Chattanooga, and the GIS department, Charlie Mix and his colleagues making these amazing maps. And yeah, all the photography. I mean, so much of the photography is from Caleb Timmerman at SEC. And then, a number of folks at Access Fund, Garrett Garner-Wells, really helping bring it all together and get it nice and packaged. So it's been a lot of hands and years worth of data in that baseline study to get to this final product. But yeah, this report, I mean, it did, the economic impact report was really part of the ramp up for this overall sort of larger report. That was the focus on economic impact and rural economic development side. And then this report builds upon that. And it starts with a baseline inventory of all the known climbing areas, all the ones we could find info about. There are certainly ones we didn't get or we didn't get as detailed as we would have liked in the state of Tennessee, and just try to understand some of the data around these climbing sites. And one of the biggest metrics was sort of protected or access is protected versus not, unsecured and secured access. And it's got some great maps that, highlight the location, the general locations of some of these sites and their access status, and then some high level stats. And I think there's a bunch of things in here. And I think, I think we could put it in the show notes for folks to get a sneak peek of it and dig into it. But one of the stats I want to highlight, I thought was when I was most interested in it from the get-go, was there's this narrative, and we talked about it a lot in this podcast already, about just all the climbing in the Southeast happening on private land. And while certainly a lot of climbing does happen on private land, and more so than the rest of the country, this report in Tennessee, we found that over 50% of the climbing that happens in the state happens on public land, right at 54%. And so while certainly there's a high number of private land climbing opportunities, there's also a really high number of public land climbing opportunities, and that includes from federal to state to municipal. It really crosses the entire gamut in Tennessee. But that baseline study was sort of the foundation of it and a really great exercise in putting all this information in one spot, because really there was not any resource like that for Tennessee. And then we sort of ran through these exercises of looking at other conservation values, whether it be climate resiliency, adjacency to public land, species, habitat protection or priority areas, watershed health, and then some other varieties that are more social on the side of, social vulnerability indexes in the state, using some of the economic impact or some of the economic info from the Appalachian Regional Commission, a variety of health factors, really taking it to a really wide swath of data and comparing it with where climbing falls in the state. And the end result is sort of this, really simple weighted overlay model that says, okay, taking all these factors, here are the priority zones that Access Fund and climbers are going to focus on in the state. And it identifies a few of those areas. And the hope there is that it helps us be a little bit more strategic in where we work, because there are just so many opportunities, and it's a really unique time in Tennessee and in the Southeast in general, where we're having a lot of opportunity to protect land, so much so that we don't have money to do it. And so we've got to be strategic, and we want to make sure we align with our other partners at conservation organizations and with the state or with federal land managers. And the overall sort of goal here is how do we be more strategic? How do we find alignment with these partners? And how do we do that in a way that's data-driven and we can lean back on?
data driven. Yes, I might be a little biased, but GIS is always the answer.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, and some of these maps are amazing. Just these full scale maps that Charlie and his crew were able to put together. And yeah, one of the funny, I mean, this is GIS jokes, I guess, or wonky jokes, is that when we were putting this together, it was one of the overall, like the centerpiece map is of the entire state of Tennessee, and it's so long you had to put it over two pages. And Charlie's advice to us, yeah, when we were trying to format it, Tennessee is a landscape presentation state for the map. You can't put it in vertical orientation; it doesn't work that way.
That's a great selling point.
Mm-hmm.
Nice, Meg. Did you want to add anything?
No, Daniel did a really great job of covering kind of from start to finish how the evolution of the report kind of came about, how we're planning to use it. I'll just kind of speak locally to what we're hoping to kind of do with that report, in addition to, of course, like talking to other land managers, looking at the climbing spaces in a strategic way and kind of being able to align those with the different priorities of these different groups from a private or public standpoint, that those kinds of principles are already in action in a lot of ways, not only in Tennessee, but Citadel is a great example. We were able to kind of look at, you know, the Thrive Regional Partnership, the priority zones. And I think the reason Citadel kind of got a lot of the attention it did from the different orgs that it did, you know, Riverview, Lyndhurst, Georgia Alabama Land Trust, is because it does fit a lot of those, you know, marks for a project that these organizations want to be involved with, the type of landscape, where it's located, the connectivity, all of that. And so I think it's another, we've talked a lot about the behind the scenes work, you know, I think this is another great thing for climbers to understand, that the land they're recreating on has a lot more value than just the climbing, and other organizations see that, and it's a reason to be involved in the stewardship and to be involved in the conservation of it. And then in addition to that, Daniel kind of alluded to this in wanting to kind of replicate this process and other places in the state. We would love to see kind of a similar approach, and it's a huge undertaking. The report is not, you're going to see this clean, cool document at the end, but my golly, a lot of work went into it, you know, so it's not an easy overnight thing. But we'd love to see that process replicated in both Alabama and Georgia, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, as well as our neighboring, you know, coalitions in those states. It's just, it's really going to be this great tool for a lot of reasons that can lead to things like the Citadel, right? Because mm-hmm. you can see alignment between all of these organizations and all these priorities, and kind of it's really easy to see, you know, where the priorities might be. So those principles have already had great positive you know, wins out of Tennessee, Alabama, Georgia, and so I just love to see it all put on paper.
Yeah, of course. I think the narrative would have to be a little bit different, but I'm just curious how it might look if there was one created for like a Western state where it is mostly federal land.
Yeah.
And you're not talking about like strategic acquisition and
right.
and purchasing places, but there's got to be, I think, some other opportunity to identify future planning for a Western state.
Yeah, I would think that the economics might play into that, because like we said, in Tennessee, there's a lot of distressed communities that have, you know, climbing opportunity there. And so mm-hmm. there's a lot of alignment. So there might be a public, you know, resource that might be resistant to climbing. And so you might be able to show how this is in alignment, not only from, you know, a recreational standpoint, but from, hey, look, climbers are conservationists, they're going to respect the land. Here's all the ways that we, you know, are overlaying and can be, you know, complementary.
Yeah, I think it's certainly a good question. Yeah, part of the intent with this effort was to, you know, duplicate it in other states. And, you know, we've got one other state in the works right now, but the focus is sort of similar, where it's really got to focus on private lands and sort of the land sure. acquisition side. But I certainly think there's a way to sort of take the same concepts and have more of that federal land manager aspect to it, and where it's less of land acquisition, but certainly still, you know, land protection in a way, and access, where, you know, just because something is owned and managed by, say, the Bureau of Land Management or the Forest Service, doesn't mean that recreation is protected on it.
Oh, 100%.
It could still certainly be jeopardized. And so, yeah, it's the argument is less, you know, acquire this land to protect it, and more like you use the federal tools that we have to, whether through a designation or some sort of boundary adjustment to get these sort of formal protections that at the end of the day still allow for the recreation to be promoted and to be developed and really be celebrated. And it can get at the same concepts, just a little bit of a different slice with navigating the federal land management side.
Exactly. And I think they could be seen as rungs as well in a way. You talked about different kinds of land designations. I mean, it could be a wilderness area, it could be an NRA, it could be any number of things that to provide maybe additional protection or different levels of protection to keep the access open and cared for.
Yeah, well, your reports take like a little over a year to do, so give me like 50 plus years and I'll get you one for every city.
for sure. Well, we know you get it done, so.
Yeah, yeah, going full circle.
Zing. Yep.
Zinger. Yeah.
I love it. I've been waiting for this opportunity. At any opportunity I have, I tell everyone his nickname that I've given him. So this is by far the best opportunity I've had to get.
I'll keep using it. Well, you guys, this has been an awesome conversation, and you've brought up the term behind the scenes multiple times, and that just really is my intent with this show, is to pull back the curtain on what folks like you are doing behind the scenes to acquire places like the Citadel and really analyze future opportunities for conservation like you guys are in Tennessee. So, I mean, you guys are putting color and putting life to what's going on behind the scenes, and I'm super grateful for folks like yourself and that are doing it and being a part of this community. Thanks so much for chatting for a bit this morning. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Peter. Great
Thanks
to be
for
on
having
again.
Us. And yeah, giving us the opportunity. It's not often we get to peel back the curtain, so really appreciate the opportunity to do it in this way. Yeah.